battlefield in an unequal combat in order to salvage humanitarian values is the only hope for national unity. In other words, it is adherence to the path of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, and promotion of the values espoused by him that could bring all the people of Iraq on a single platform in view of the forthcoming general elections, irrespective of their ethnic, political, and sectarian differences. To be more precise, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, is the bulwark against treason and the treacherous plots of the traitors who want to sell Iraq to the Zionists and who like to keep the country under American military occupation. Iran has showed to the world that the key to the victory of Islamic Revolution in 1979, the thwarting of the Ba'athist invasion during the Eight-Year War, and the defeat of all American plots against the power and prestige of the country and the unity of the nation is treading the path of the immortal martyr of Karbala and promoting his values in society. We earnestly hope that Iraq and other countries will follow suit. Then only will the dignity and independence of the Muslim Ummah will be ensured, and the struggle for liberation of Islam's former Qibla, Bayt al-Muqaddas, and the whole of Palestine will bear fruits.
Ministry.
In light of the accelerating battlefield changes in Yemen, which were represented in the Yemeni armed forces being able in record time to liberate four districts in Shabwa Governorate and two new districts in Ma'arib Governorate, while approaching the safer oil fields, an atmosphere of pessimism prevailed among Yemeni circles loyal to the U.S.-Saudi coalition aggression. Meanwhile, many tribes and political, social, and military figures began to open channels of communication with the Sana'a government. This comes while the shuttle tours of the UN envoys Hans Grundberg and the American Tim Lenderking between the Saudi and Omani capitals have so far failed to achieve any result, which may put the Saudis in front of a single option of responding to the demand to lift the air, sea, and land blockade. Washington and Riyadh are still unable to fathom how the recent field gains of the Sana'a resistance forces secured several strategic goals at such a record time and gave them a future advantage in reaching the shores of the Arabian Sea for the first time since the beginning of the war, as well as controlling oil and gas sources in the governorates of Shabwa and Ma'arib. The recent battlefield developments in Yemen are not deprived of the regional and international context. It seems that Sana'a resistance forces have mastered their investment in pushing for dramatic changes on the ground, who was waiting only for the right moment, given that the military readiness for them has always been available. Sana'a, which possesses the reins of control over the ground events, took advantage of the recent transformations in the region, starting with the arrival of a new, more assertive administration to power in Iran, through the withdrawal of the United States of America from Afghanistan, and the latest American retreat in Syria and Lebanon to push for dramatic changes on the Yemeni map. Although the Yemeni resistance on Sadullah tried to take the path of peace through the Ma'arib initiative that was presented to the Omani delegation that visited Sana'a months ago, both Riyadh and Washington opted to dodge this opportunity and rather bet on the failure of the Yemeni armed forces attack on Ma'arib. Big mistake. Huge. Likewise, the Saudi and American sides did not take seriously the shift in political discourse in Sana'a towards drawing the features of the post-Ma'arib period, as stated by the leader of Ansarullah, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, at the beginning of September when he affirmed, "We will liberate all our country and we will take back all the areas occupied by the coalition of aggression." The man does what he says. Well, don't all resistance leaders do? Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. As the Yemeni armed forces continues its advance on the strategic city of Ma'rib, local reports claim that as of 23rd of September, Ansarullah resistance fighters have liberated 10 out of 14 districts in the oil-rich province. The reports come just one day after all remaining Saudi coalition forces in the district of Al-Abdiya, just south of Ma'rib, surrendered to the Yemeni armed forces and to the popular committees. Following days of intense fighting, the Yemeni army has liberated large swaths of the Saudi-led coalition's last northern stronghold. To discuss this issue with us from London is Patrick Henningsen, who is founder of the 21st Century Wire and host of the Sunday Wire, which broadcasts live on the alternate current radio network. Thank you very much for being with us, Patrick. By controlling the entire Bayhan district in the Shabwa governorate, that's in eastern Yemen, the Sana'a forces have succeeded in separating the governorate completely from its neighbor Ma'rib, which means that only one single and difficult supply line will remain in front of the forces which are loyal to Abd Rabbu Mansur Hadi, which basically are Saudi mercenaries, from the direction of Hadramaut governorate. Is this it? Are we at a point where Mohammed bin Salman will now stop this unnecessary war and try dialogue for a change?
Well, this is interesting because we're approaching the seven-year anniversary in not too long, this coming March of 2022. So this is turning into, in the sort of a way, Saudi Arabia or MBS's Vietnam, as it were. But really, when you look at this, how this all came about in 2015, is really an Obama-era disaster that no matter how they tried to reorient it and add pieces to it and take away pieces, it was doomed to failure from the beginning. And just from a strategic point of view, Saudi Arabia completely underestimated the will and the determination and the resourcefulness of Ansarullah Allah. But not only that, they overestimated the effectiveness of the proxy, various proxy forces and mercenary components that they brought in. Not just Saudi Arabia overestimating that, but the United States as well. Because this, for the most part, this has been really a U.S.-led effort, but with Saudi playing the lead role. The U.S. has outsourced the lead role in public to a local enforcer, which is the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm. Well, Patrick, one very important thing happened, which is by controlling when the army and the popular committee controlled the Harib district, which is to overcome major obstacles in front of them to advance towards the actual city of Ma'rib from the south upwards and to pave the way to control the safer oil field from more than just one direction and with the least possible losses here. But in the event that the armed forces actually get to the oil field and start retaking the area that was taken by the mercenaries for so long, will the government in Sana'a be able to at least export this oil and try to break this American Saudi siege?
Well, that might be difficult. That might be difficult. It's unclear. But what they will have, what Sana'a definitely will have, is access to its own domestic energy resources. In so many ways, this mirrors this what the operation that was taken against Syria by the U.S. and all of its various allies and Saudi Arabia, where they basically cut off northeastern Syria and the oil fields in Syria that caused poverty, that caused a crisis, that all sorts of problems in the rest of Syria. The same sort of tactic they've employed here, and not only that, Saudi Arabia siphoning off the oil and then using, selling it, and then depositing those revenues in their own banks, and maybe using that to fund their Sudanese mercenary armies or the UAE, the subcontracting that they've brought in, the various special forces that they've pulled in into this sort of quagmire. So it'll give the Yemenis the ability to not only have access to their own resources, be able to fuel vehicles, be able to do things with that and possibly sell it, but the West and Saudi Arabia will still have the ability, I think, to blockade. They're not going to take the Ansarullah's ultimate victory in Ma'rib lightly. They will probably put additional pressure on. they'll say this is a violation of this UN resolution, of this so-called peace deal that they dreamt up, that very much mirrors Idlib. Just as Damascus was ready to take Idlib, you saw the international outcry. Millions of people, women and children are going to die if Syria retakes its own province, and they've done the same type of tactic here in Yemen to protect Marib because it is such a strategically, such an important component on this battlefield.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps the most remarkable thing in this development of the past week is the high-level coordination between the Yemeni resistance factions and the tribes in the area in northern Yemen, whose position continues to turn unfavorably to the Emirati-Saudi alliance, obviously patroned by the U.S. Now, how was Ansarullah capable of changing the position towards one favorable for the Sana'a government instead of continuing with the path drawn to them by Mohammed bin Salman?
Yeah, I think it's interesting when Mohammed bin Salman took this project on, he was quite young, relatively, and so now he's probably looking back thinking, well, it seemed like a good idea at the time, but the Ansarullah's ability to get to bring some of the tribal factions together in the last year, in the last 12 months, has just seen a steady improvement, and we're reaching that climax right now with Marib and this area that is so key. Not only that, but this is the direct connection to Hudaida as well and other parts of the country. So this could very much break the back of the Saudi Arabian effort to prosecute what, by all accounts, if you look at any international measure of international law, this is an absolutely illegal, undeclared war of aggression. The oppression, the torture of the country of Yemen, how this coalition has done this and got away with it is just incredible.
Well, in the face of this military transformation, we saw that the Islah Party leaders declared a state of public mobilization in the city of Ma'rib and created what they are calling defense lines near of Ataq area, which has been the alternative stronghold of Islah to Ma'rib since August 2019, ever since Ma'rib started falling in the hands of Ansarullah. What is the Islah Party counting on with this mobilization? I mean, wouldn't it be less of a loss for them to at least start a conversation or a dialogue, a peace talk with Sana'a instead of actually putting bets, loss bets here? It's just, they can't bet on anything anymore. Not even Saudi Arabia is willing to help them out.
No. I don't think there's going to be, in terms of dialogue, it's very difficult because the Saudi Arabian coalition has really kind of nailed its colors to the mast, as it were. You know, they went all out with an international effort and support from the West to try to create this illusion that somehow the government in Sana'a is defending its own territory is illegitimate, and then the government in exile of Mansour Hadi is somehow illegitimate. And then this peace deal was constructed about this. Saudi Arabia will really lose face. Saudi Arabia will end up throwing more resources at it, more band-aids, and really with failure being the ultimate conclusion at the end.
Which would definitely create turmoil inside Saudi Arabia itself. I want to thank you very much, Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire news website and host of the Sunday Wire, which broadcasts live on the alternate current radio network. Thank you very much for being with us. Now, please stay tuned because next we will be talking about what is going on in Erbil.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Chief of the General Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Hossein Bahiri, stressed last week that Iran will not tolerate any hostile movements on its own borders, announcing that Iraq and the Kurdistan region should not allow the mercenaries of America and Israel to set up training camps on Iran's borders. Now, Bahiri also noted that the operations that Iran started in the past 2 weeks will continue. Now, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard has recently launched a series of strikes on the sites of the anti-Iranian militants in northern Iraq, and Tehran demanded the Iraqi government to take steps to prevent the activities of these groups. Meanwhile, drones and missile attacks on Erbil International Airport in northern Iraq have become a norm, where U.S.-led coalition troops and reportedly Mossad are stationed there. Now, Kurdish-Mossad relations threaten to ignite West Asia in this following report.
The escalation between Iran and Israel intensified through the expansion of military and intelligence targeting the interests of the parties involved in the region, specifically at the beginning of April 2021. From mutual targeting of ships in the waters of the Persian Gulf and the Mediterranean Sea to Israeli cyber intelligence reportedly sabotaging power generators inside the Iranian Natanz nuclear site, the main aim for Israel is to negatively influence Iran's negotiating position in Vienna regarding the U.S. attempt to return back to the JCPOA agreement with Iran that was signed with the P5+1 in July 2015. By the middle of April, the confrontation between the Israeli entity and the Islamic Republic of Iran moved to a new round in Iraq. This confrontation took place specifically in the Iraqi Kurdistan, where an armed group targeted one of the bases rumored to be affiliated with the Israeli intelligence services Mossad in the capital Erbil on the 14th of April. The Kurdistan government denied the presence of Israeli intelligence centers on its territory, yet the history of relations between the Iraqi Kurdish leaders and the Zionist entity speaks otherwise. The armed attack on an Israeli intelligence center in Kurdistan comes as a result of the successive accusations leveled by Iran against the Erbil government for allowing the region to become a spying arena for Israel, harming the interests of Iraq, in addition to similar accusations against the Iraqi Kurdistan National Party for allowing Israel to establish an intelligence center in Sulaymaniyah. Targets against Israeli interests in Erbil were not only against Mossad, as per the Cradle News website. A senior resistance Axis security official claimed that the Axis is responsible for the deaths of an American and Israeli commander in retaliation for the assassinations of Iranian Quds Force Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Iraq's deputy commander of the Hashd al-Shaabi Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. According to the Cradle security source, an operation in Erbil killed two high-ranking American and Israeli commanders, Lieutenant Colonel James C. Willis, 55, of Albuquerque and the Red Horse Unit, was an American commander killed in an operation in Erbil, although according to a Pentagon report, he died in a non-combat incident at Qatar's Al Udeid base. This person was involved in the assassination operations of Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Also, Israeli Colonel Sharon Azman of the Nahal Brigade, said to have died of heart failure, was another person killed in Erbil. This is the very first time a Resistance Axis official has claimed responsibility for retaliatory measures against the killers of the Iranian and Iraqi generals. However, from the looks of it, Erbil seems to have become an open target for the resistance against the threat of the attempted Israeli expansion in West Asia.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Sharmeen Narwani, journalist and columnist at the English language news magazine The Cradle, which covers West Asian politics. Thanks a million for being with us, Sharmeen. Now, attacks inside Erbil are on the rise, targeting U.S. presence in Baghdad as well as other bases across Iraq, especially in the Kurdistan region, one of which is reportedly to be inhabited by Israeli intelligence Mossad. In Erbil. Now, in July, rockets landed in and around the fortified green zone of Baghdad, as well as other places in Erbil up north, which was very, if you will, surprising for the area. Now, the U.S. claims that it only caused a damage, material damage, and no lives were lost. Yet, the Cradle reported that a senior resistance Axis security official said that the Axis is responsible for the deaths of an American and an Israeli commander in retaliation, in direct retaliation for the assassinations of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the Quds Force General, and Iraq's Deputy Commander of the Hashd al-Sha'bi, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Can you maybe tell us more about this?
Yeah, we had some information very recently from a very senior official within the Resistance Access Alliance, and the information was a surprise to us because it was the first time that we'd heard confirmation of any retaliation against individuals for involved in the assassinations of Soleimani and Muhandis. So that in itself was something interesting, and I think particularly so because it had come on the back of a New York Times in-depth feature article describing breathlessly how they had killed Fakhrizadeh, the Iranian nuclear scientist.
Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, yes.
With, you know, artificial intelligence used remote control, I don't know, guns or whatever. And so, you know, I think perhaps it was time for the Axis to strike back. And so they revealed this information. I mean, that is just my own assessment of why this information was released. But basically, the American Lieutenant Colonel James Willis was killed, and so was the Israeli Colonel Sharon Asman. And these two men were specifically said to have participated in the assassinations of the two Iranian-Iraqi generals. And I think early on the Resistance Axis said they know the names of everyone involved and they're going to go after them. We did hear in mid-April of a hit on Erbil where apparently Mossad agents were targeted, and another one in late June, early July. We don't know when this hit took place, but like I said, we have confirmation that the Resistance Axis has now acted against the perpetrators of the assassinations of their Iraqi and Iranian general. And of course, the U.S. and Israeli military commands have, in both cases, said that these men died in non-combat situations. Lieutenant Colonel Willis died of a heart attack, according to the Americans, in Udeid military base in Qatar. And the Israeli Colonel Asman died during a jog with his unit. Asman served in both combat situations in Lebanon and in Gaza. So it seems,
and mind you, both of them were really not that old in age.
They weren't that old, and it reminds you actually of the incident where, you know, the Iranians shot a dozen ballistic missiles as retaliation for the assassinations into two U.S. bases in Iraq, and said nobody was hurt. And then over the months ahead, we heard of many head conditions and head injuries for over 100 U.S. soldiers. So they're not about to release this information. And I have information, I mean, they're unconfirmed rumors at this point, but that captives were taken from the Erbil operation. So it would be, it would, you know, one would understand if that were true that the Americans and Israelis really want to keep this under wraps.
Well, it's going to come out into the open when time comes. But until recently, the attacks were a frequent occurrence. Now, the U.S. has blamed what it says are Iran-backed militias for these attacks. More recently, the attacks have become more sophisticated. No more missiles, but drones. Drones that can hold certain kilograms of detonative substances that could explode on impact. Why is it too hard for the U.S. to believe that it can actually be the Hashd al-Sha'bi in Iraq, that they do have the capabilities and the training to do so? Why do they pin everything on Iran?
Well, the Hashd al-Sha'bi, I mean, elements of the Hashd al-Sha'bi have been trained by Iran, and Iran did supply weapons to Iraqis who gathered to fight, who mobilized to fight the ISIS threat. You know, in times of conflict and war, small arms are uncontrolled, and as you see in Yemen, everybody has a weapon, and they can they take it to more sophisticated levels all the time. I think, you know, we've seen Al-Qaeda operate weaponized drones in Syria, and we've seen other militant groups throughout the region and elsewhere operate weaponized drones. So it's not inconceivable that this could be done
by... U.S. Forces are saying that they will end their combat mission in Iraq by the end of this year, but will reportedly continue to both train and advise Iraqi military. Can you tell us, train them against whom exactly, and how much similar will that withdrawal be to the scenes that we saw, the horrific scenes that we saw coming out of Afghanistan?
You know, I think a lot of countries that receive U.S. military training post-Afghanistan have to reassess whether the training amounts to anything. You know, the U.S. trained the Afghan army, but it has also trained the Iraqi army and security forces who fled the scene in Mosul when ISIS invaded the city. And, of course, they trained the Lebanese armed forces, and Lebanon gets ever-increasing amounts of millions of U.S. dollars for these kind of activities. I don't anticipate that the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq will look like the one in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, the Taliban, their opponents, the U.S. Opponents during the 20 years of war had already taken back large swathes of the country and were poised at that point to enter Kabul. And so, you know, it was a very scattered, very badly executed withdrawal. U.S. allies were not even informed about timing and logistics of the withdrawal and have complained loudly since then. So it was very badly done. In Iraq, it's a different situation. The U.S. has cordial relations with the government in Baghdad, and have suggested that these withdrawals will take place incrementally. And of course, there are few U.S. troops in Iraq, and they're all under guard and in facilities and not on the streets. So I assume the withdrawal there will be also conducted with more care, given what's happened in Afghanistan. U.S. President Joe Biden can't afford another scene like that.
Definitely. Thank you very much, Sharmeen Irwani, journalist and columnist at the English language news magazine, The Cradle, which covers West Asian politics. It was a pleasure having you on. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Train.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Members of the European Parliament's Industry Committee voted on Tuesday, September 28, to allow the EU to continue subsidizing natural gas pipelines until the end of 2027, as long as the energy is mixed with an unspecified amount of hydrogen. Here we present you an article in this regard written by Jennifer Rankin titled, EU Lawmakers Vote to Prolong Fossil Fuel Gas Subsidies Until 2027. The article was published by The Guardian Daily. Please stay tuned. European lawmakers have voted to prolong subsidies for fossil fuel gas until 2027, opening a potential backdoor for pollution that campaigners said would be a disaster for the climate if it becomes law. Members of the European Parliament's Industry Committee voted on Tuesday, September 28, to allow the EU to continue subsidizing natural gas pipelines until the end of 2027, as long as the energy is mixed with an unspecified amount of hydrogen. Hydrogen, which can be made from fossil gas or renewable sources, is seen by policymakers as a vital stepping stone to net zero emissions by 2050. The committee also voted to allow natural gas projects such as pipelines and storage facilities to be eligible for special status that will speed up their approval, although they ruled out access to EU grants for such projects. Campaigners estimate between 50 and 70 natural gas projects could obtain Project of Common Interest status, an EU seal of approval that helps plans get off the drawing board, gain access to finance and exemptions from EU competition rules. The campaign group Global Witness estimates that about 70 gas projects could be eligible, producing 213 metric tons of CO2 emissions a year, equivalent to Germany's coal burning in 2018. The two controversial amendments to the EU's Trans-European Energy Infrastructure Regulation were approved by MEPs barely 3 months after the European Commission said the world was entering a make-or-break decade to tackle the climate crisis. The Commission's original 10E text proposed sweeping away special status for all natural gas projects as part of the Union's effort to hit net zero emissions by 2050. In May, the International Energy Agency said rich countries should decarbonize electricity generation by 2035, while calling for an immediate stop to the approval of new oil and gas fields. The European Parliament, which elected a record number of green MEPs in 2019, is usually the most ambitious player on the climate emergency in the world of EU lawmaking. However, on this occasion, campaigners were surprised and disappointed when MEPs watered down the original plans by allowing natural gas companies to continue competing for a special status and opened the door for subsidies for any gas company that claims to be hydrogen ready. Under the Parliament's compromise on blending, energy companies blending an unspecified mix of fossil fuel gas and hydrogen are eligible for EU subsidies until 2027, as long as they have a plan to drop gas by the end of the decade. Even once EU subsidies are stripped away, the same gas hydrogen pipeline will be eligible for fast-track approval until the end of 2029. Position was drafted by Zdzisław Krasnodowski, a member of Poland's ultra-conservative Law and Justice Party, who is vice chair of the Parliament's Industry Committee. He said the objective of this revision is to align the 10E regulation with the objectives of the European Green Deal. However, we should also bear in mind that energy union priorities remain valid and should still be reflected in the rules governing the support for important energy infrastructure projects. In addition to sustainability, he said projects would be evaluated based on their contribution to energy security, market integration, and affordability for consumers. His final compromise was supported by most MEPs in the largest political groups, including the center-right European People's Party, the center-left Socialists and Democrats, and the centrist Renew Group. Green MEPs abstained. The Parliament will now enter negotiations with EU energy ministers, who left much less room for gas projects when they agreed their negotiating red lines earlier this year. Tara Connolly, a senior campaigner at Global Witness, said, "Today's vote would be a disaster for the climate if it ends up being reflected in the final law," adding, "The science is clear. We need to urgently phase out fossil gas to prevent the worst effects of climate breakdown. EU member states must not fall for this giveaway to the fossil fuel industry and close the loopholes which would allow fossil gas subsidies when negotiations start." Erik Bergqvist, a Swedish Social Democrat MEP involved in the compromise, claimed it was the best possible agreement. Erik said, "What would be the alternative have been? Of course, we could have stepped off negotiations, but then we know we would have had a result that would have been much worse. The main thing that we have been asking for is an end date for fossil fuel investment. It's better to have an end date, otherwise there wouldn't be a phase out." He voiced optimism that EU-subsidized fossil fuel gas would only exist in small quantities when blended with low CO2 hydrogen. He noted, "We have to remember that blending is low carbon. The main proportion will be renewable hydrogen gas." While he acknowledged that the fossil gas hydrogen mix had yet to be defined, a task for another EU negotiation, he insisted it would be quite narrow and quite tough on fossil fuels. The hydrogen fossil gas blend cannot be 95% carbon dioxide. Green campaigners do not share this optimism. They would reserve scarce and expensive renewable hydrogen for industries that are difficult to decarbonize, such as fertilizers. Connolly said mixing hydrogen with natural gas is not efficient, adding, "You want to use hydrogen where it is most valuable, otherwise you put a huge amount of cost on everyone." A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Iran's endeavor to gain full status as a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization has been approved after about 15 years. Approved by all permanent members of the organization. Full membership will mean substantial leverage and clout in the Eurasian alliance for Iran. In recent months, Iran and China have been working on a wide-ranging, long-term political, economic, and security accord that would inject hundreds of billions of dollars of investments into the Iranian financial markets and infrastructure. Iran has been also exploring a similar long-term pact with Russia. Political leaders in Tehran perceive these actions as a necessary means of overcoming U.S. hegemony and economic terrorism. According to geopolitical analysts, a convergence of interests is bringing Iran, Russia, and China closer together than ever before. Iran earlier signed a multidimensional 25-year strategic treaty with China, and is prepared to do the same with Russia in the near future. Now, this country has ascended to the SCO. This can be seen as a third decisive move in Iran's inclination towards the East. I'm Ela Faramazi, and you're watching Iran Today. In this episode, we'll be assessing Iran's membership in the SCO, or Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Iran's, so to speak, new strategy of becoming a pivot to the East involves developing dynamic economic, political, military, and security alliances with Eastern giants, basically China, India, and Russia. This approach has gained all the more credence among Iranian officials since former U.S. President Donald Trump's misguided move of withdrawing from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, and his conducting maximum pressure policies towards Iran. Whether membership to the SCO and long-term deals with China and Russia can actually serve as Eastern equivalents to the JCPOA, our expert explains. Mr. Hadidi is the Iran-China Chamber board director. I'd say he's got a pretty good sense of how deals with the East might pan out for Iran and its economy.
It is in our country's interest to work with countries in the world that have a future, and more importantly, are energy consumers, because fossil fuels are expected to run dry in the not-so-distant future. We have a couple of decades to make the best use of our underground energy resources. India and China are the world's two greatest importers of fossil fuels. Iran and Russia are two countries with the richest underground energy resources in the region.
Sure enough, Iran has found receptive collaborators in the East. Tehran, Moscow, and Beijing oppose the U.S. military and interventionist policies and seek to eliminate the supremacy of the U.S. economy in the Eurasian region. This is not to say Iran will be amplifying tensions and foregoing relations with the West. The SCO, or Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which grew from the Shanghai Five Pact, was established in 2001 by the leaders of China, Russia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. The aim was to balance multilateral security and economic and cultural cooperation, aiming at balancing U.S. and NATO influence in the Eurasian region. Mr. Moradian is PhD in international law and advises the MOD, and he came down to the studio to tell of security benefits Iran's upgraded membership could have for this country.
Shanghai Cooperation Organization can create a defense and security alliance in the future. It has not reached that convergence at the moment. The reason being the heterogeneity of the member states. The member states now have economic and political disparities, so we cannot expect their organization to become a NATO-like regional defense organization in the short term. Maybe this will happen in the future, and Iran at that time could use a lot of these benefits of the organization.
The SCO permanent and non-permanent members are the world's largest producers and consumers of energy, with an area of about a third of the Earth's land surface and about half of the world's population, with strong potential to balance power and create a multipolar world. Question is, will Iran's permanent membership to the SCO be an equal win for Iran and the rest of that organization?
We shouldn't ignore the realities of the organization. We think that the organization can help us improve and solve the problems caused by sanctions. But this is not the case. U.S. sanctions are aimed primarily at private institutions and international financial institutions. None of these countries and no international organization in the world can force the private sector to cooperate with us and guarantee that it will not face U.S. sanctions if it enters into a financial transaction with Iran. And no organization or country will ever enter this game. It could even be a trap for Iran if it enters into discussions with countries on this issue, because they can get good economic concessions from Iran and give nothing back to us.
Both political and economic factors are of concern in analyzing Iran's membership. Hostility and the ongoing U.S. sanctions system have always restrained the development of Iran's international trade, depriving it of the benefits of external markets or foreign investment for financial and infrastructure projects, for example, transportation and communications. But sanctions have mainly impacted tourism and oil and gas industries. Now, in hoping to alleviate this problem, Iran is looking to the east, because Iran is an energy power after all. Mr. Vafai is a China affairs analyst and university professor.
One thing about looking east is that Iran is not going to ignore the West. As the name of the approach suggests, Tehran will be looking at the east, that is establishing a balance in the Islamic Republic's foreign policy. We've always witnessed Iran's foreign policy swaying from favoring the East or the West every time a new government takes power in Tehran, an issue that isn't in the country's interests. The concept of looking at the East must be approached with caution so we won't turn into jumping to the East's arms. We need to look at the West too. Looking at the East shouldn't result in turning our backs on the West. As a matter of fact, looking at the East can only benefit us when we can create a balance in our foreign policy to have ties with both the West and the East.
Iran, Russia, and China have actually discussed de-dollarization of their trade for decades and have considered launching an alternative to the SWIFT global network, SWIFT standing for Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunication. Talking of Iran's permanent membership, after the technical and legal process concludes, which could take up to 2 years, Iran will formally join a group that accounts for exports worth trillions of dollars annually. That's because SCO includes China, Russia, and India, in addition to several Central Asian and Eurasian states. How do you see Iran going about making the most of its membership, economically and security-wise?
We have many problems in banking and financial relations. If these problems are not solved, all these things will fail. We have to deal with FATF. This is a serious issue, and no organization or institution can address it. Iran cannot hope to resolve this issue with regional agreements, such as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or even other bilateral agreements. Because if there is a banking transaction to or from Iran, the FATF, as a transaction monitoring body, warns the other party that they are exposed to a serious risk in terms of money laundering and terrorism financing. Basically, if Iran does not solve its problems with the FATF, it will lose the opportunities it can get from membership in the Shanghai Organization, among many others.
Iran's new president, Ebrahim Raisi, has not been the singular leading figure in this country's foreign policy decision-making process. But he is part of an establishment that laid out the central contour of the next phase of Iran's foreign policy. And his government will have to pursue this path, the path of displacing the JCPOA as the focal point of our foreign policy. Addressing the recent SCO summit in Dushanbe, Raisi said, "When I took over the presidency of the Islamic Republic, I introduced my foreign policy orientation as focusing on economic multilateralism, strengthening relations with neighboring countries in its broadest sense, and strengthening presence in regional organizations." He then called for strengthening bilateral cooperation in order to improve the strategic role of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in the global economy. Iran owns the world's second largest natural gas reserves and the fourth largest oil reserves, which position it as a significant actor in the strategic calculations that Eurasian powers make in their foreign policy toward the Middle East or West Asia. For instance, by strategic collaboration with Iran, Beijing and Moscow would have a unique opportunity to redirect both Iran and its regional rivals towards the China-Russia-Eurasian strategic construct.
The U.S. and China might be heading into a confrontation in the Asia-Pacific region. It's likely, and we've seen some of its signs with the latest trilateral agreement between U.S., U.K. and Australia, that military lines are being drawn there. In such a scenario, the Persian Gulf countries will have to navigate routes through straits like Taiwan, which will be very unsafe to sell their oil to China. Iran and Russia are the only two energy-rich nations that can sell fuel to China through pipelines.
In line with the U.S.'s failure in wars on Afghanistan and Iraq and its partnership with Saudi Arabia in attacking Yemen, it has become clear that the United States no longer functions as the dominant superpower in West Asia. Traditional allies of the U.S. are in profound crises and their positions are particularly weakened. Also, the U.S. withdrawal from international treaties such as the JCPOA have seriously called into question the legitimacy and credibility of that country, unlike China. Would you say Eastern countries are uniting as opposed to the West?
Anyway, Eastern countries are uniting under the banner of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. But it's important to remain realistic. The member states are not at all seeking to challenge the world order. They're not trying to stand against NATO and declare themselves their opposite number at all. While they accept the international system's order, they're introducing themselves as another potential pole alongside the others. I've read in some analyses that the West is scared now that Iran's a permanent member of the Shanghai Organization. It's not like that.
Apart from the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, there are other similar regional organizations too, like the ASEAN, which is an important one, or the G8 and others. Japan, South Korea, and even Australia are members of some of them. A few months ago, a treaty dubbed RSAP was introduced in the region, in which Australia, India, ASEAN nations, China, and others clinched an economic pact. I don't think it would make much difference. Geographically speaking, what are we considering nations like Japan, South Korea, and the Philippines? Are they Eastern or Western nations?
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
There's plenty more of our narrative coming up, but first, let's give other media outlets a chance to have their say. Here's how those other outlets put it in words. IntelliNews tells of how Iran's options, alternatives, are a reality. Iran's economy less troubled than Washington would like and turning to the east. The words Iranian economy and collapse are presently so closely linked in the media narrative that the imminent collapse of Iran has become one of those truths that hardly needs stating. The numbers, though, tell a different story. U.S. strategy towards Iran, whose objective is to topple the Islamic Republic by fomenting mass dissent among the poor and unemployed, using sanctions as a catalyst, looks like being as successful as U.S. strategy in Afghanistan. Iran, whose economy is demonstrably considerably healthier than the consensus suggests, and much healthier than some major economies we could mention, has been driven firmly into the China-Russia camp, where it will prosper. To add insult to the self-inflicted injury, those barrels of oil will not be traded in U.S. dollars, but in yuan, another step in the slow but steady de-dollarization of world trade, which is already ringing alarm bells in the offices of longer-sighted U.S. strategists. Trapped by their own rhetoric, the U.S., Israel, and the E3 are probably now too late to prevent Iran from becoming a firm member of the Sinosphere with an economy that is stubbornly refusing to lie down and die. The Atlantic Council tells of how the situation in Afghanistan might have led to Iran's ascension to the STO. With the U.S. out of Afghanistan, Iran jumps on the opportunity of joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Since the United States pulled out from Afghanistan, there has been much speculation that China stands to benefit. The logic appears to be zero-sum. The U.S. has left, so China will jump in to fill that space, bringing Afghanistan into the Belt and Road Initiative, BRI, and Beijing's growing sphere of influence in Central Asia. There are good reasons to be skeptical of this line of thinking. For starters, China and Afghanistan are not natural partners. At the same time, the manner in which the U.S. departed Afghanistan could lead to Eurasian alignments that are not in Washington's interests, especially where Iran is concerned. Full Iranian membership would certainly benefit Tehran. Any international acceptance is welcome news for the Iranian government. That China and Russia lead the SCO is another plus, providing Iran with great power support in its ongoing struggle with the U.S. Moscow's consistent calls for a polycentric world order and Beijing's for a more democratic one are consistent with Tehran's concerns about U.S. power. It also builds upon the momentum from the China-Iran Comprehensive Strategic Partnership. Can Iran's membership to the SCO hold the West hostage? The Tehran Times reads, ex-ambassador, SCO membership will force the West to provide facilities to Iran. A former Iranian ambassador to China and Russia has said that with Iran's permanent membership in the SCO, the West will understand that the space for Iran will not be limited. The comment by Safadi comes as Iran has been subject to sanctions by the West, especially after the former Trump administration quit the 2015 nuclear agreement and slapped the harshest sanctions in history against Iran. The member countries of the organization are noticing that the foreign policy perspective of Raisi's administration is more focused on neighboring countries, Commonwealth of Independent States, CIS countries, and Asian countries in general. And for this reason, they have welcomed Iran's permanent membership. That would be it for this segment. Do stay tuned. Another regional issue that will have a serious impact throughout Eurasia has to do with the recent developments in Afghanistan. The Taliban have once again taken over the war-torn Afghan nation following the withdrawal of American troops. China, Russia, and Iran have blamed Washington for having created such a chaos in the region, as they believe America withdrew without cleaning up its mess. The SCO countries now have no choice but to come together to stave off Afghanistan's impending humanitarian crisis that could lead to a new regional refugee crisis and provide fertile ground for terrorist activities of militant groups such as Daesh or ISIS.
In today's international system, we are witnessing what can be described as a depletion of the potential for power from the Atlantic to the Pacific. This is a fact that all countries are aware of. Even the Americans themselves have Japanese and British think tanks arguing about this. The developments that are taking place in the region all indicate the same thing. We also witnessed the events that took place in the Persian Gulf and Afghanistan. At close inspection, we'll realize that the weight of developments is moving towards Southeast Asia. As a result, Iran is not alone in looking at the East. Many others have made the same observation and are looking at the East. Turkey and Saudi Arabia are doing so, because the observation corresponds to the current realities in the international system.
Afghanistan's geo-economic importance goes beyond boosting connectivity as a north-south or east-west corridor, given its deposit of strategic minerals and metals, valued at over $1 trillion. Russia, China, and other SCO countries thus perceive an extra incentive to stabilize Afghanistan in order to access strategic minerals that are critical to building the high-tech products that will drive the coming industrial revolution and the batteries that will be needed for power. Afghanistan is the crucible for the SCO. If it collapses into chaos, the SCO's capacity and effectiveness will come under question.
As it would seem, as far as Iran is concerned, its membership in the SCO would enhance its soft security by enabling it to better manage the chaotic situation